Listen to Six Music on the BBC Sounds app and discover all our latest shows, sessions and mixes.
Six Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today.
Distant flickering, screen of scenery, I swear that's bringing it all back again. Great adventures, faces in condensation, I'm going outside to take it all. Something out of step, throw a stranger an unexpected smile, with big intention, still posted at your station, always on about the day it should have.
Today's guest is someone for whom music is never static. How she writes, what she writes about, how she records, what instrumentation, interfaces or technologies she uses, how and where she plays, how she distributes her music, how she communicates with her audience, all these are constantly evolving ideas for her. This isn't innovation and experimentation for the sake of it, and it's never at the expense of her skills as a songwriter, but my guest can't stand still creatively when there might be a new idea just around the corner. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time, Imogen Heap. In this conversation, we discuss Imogen's earliest connections to music, formative, not always friction-free, experiences at college and the Brit School, and how she ended up signing her first record contract when she was just 18. We cover her first visit to the studio and finding success with the band Fru Fru, and the story behind her first full solo album, Speak For Yourself, in 2005, which, in a move that was very much ahead of her time, she funded herself completely to keep total artistic control. We also discuss why so many people have sampled her work, people including Jason Derulo, Lil Wayne and A$AP Rocky. Also the afterlife of her famous track Headlock, working with AI and the song that she scientifically created to make babies happy. I started by asking Imogen, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
We always had a piano, so I guess that was the first time. And Mum sings. She's constantly singing, stimming maybe. And so, yeah, singing and playing the piano would be normal from day one.
And in terms of the first time that music kind of impacted on you, the first time you were aware of, like, this is a piece that is speaking to me, that's a different thing, isn't it, than it just being, like, on the radio?
The radio was definitely Michael Jackson.
Right.
It was bad. I just thought that was the best thing ever, and I would parade around in, like, some dustbin liners around my legs and do the moonwalk badly. Yeah, I was big into Michael Jackson. I had a Michael Jackson calendar. I had the moonwalk book. I went to Sunday school for a couple of weekends. I thought that if God knew that I believed in him because I went to Sunday school, then maybe he'd, like, be able to triangulate a conversation between me and Michael Jackson. And after my first time learning about Adam and Eve and whatever, I came back home. My parents were very surprised that I wanted to go to Sunday school, but it was very important to me. I had to speak to Michael Jackson. So then I came back home, went to bed early and sat on my bed and prayed. And I didn't get any message back. So I was pretty annoyed. But I gave it one more go and that was that. That was the end. There was no more Sunday school after that. And I've been a bit suspicious of the whole thing, really, ever since.
Some of those Michael Jackson, in fact, a lot of those Michael Jackson records, the production is pretty far out for like what's mainstream pop music, yeah. and so ambitious and inventive. So I guess being in tune with that was a kind of a prediction of what you would start to find appealing in your later life.
Tickled my fancy. Lots of vocalisations, lots of things kind of laying on top of each other. Just great riffs, really like bass and drum heavy. And there are a few songs I didn't like that I felt were a bit sappy.
Yeah.
But most of the time I was like, it got me excited. I didn't hear really anything else on the radio that was anywhere close to that. It was all like Kylie Minogue and Jason Donovan. But Michael Jackson was just different, yeah.
First music you owned, did you own a Michael Jackson record, or does that come later?
I think the first cassette that I owned was something that I got in a petrol station on a way to a very long family car journey to Scotland, which was just incredibly long and painful. And I remember there's lots of rain, which is quite nice, we're in the back of the car, but we were just moaning the whole way. And my mum and my brother, they got a hold of Tango in the Night, which I really loved, the album.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful album. So that, I suppose, was the first album that I really got to know before Michael Jackson came into my life.
Yeah.
Not enough, but there we go. But it was Bobby Brown, My Prerogative, that album was the one that I got from the petrol station. And I think my sister got Now, whatever it would have been, 83 or something like that. So Bobby Brown, My Prerogative was in the... It wasn't the bargain bin, it was like right there.
Yeah.
So, and I loved that. I did actually really like that album. Yeah.
So when's the moment when you first think, well, actually, okay, this is something I love. Maybe I can do that. I mean, learning instruments, but like I could compose something.
Yeah, I never put the two together. That's music there on the radio with people singing that and dancing, doing those things on the videos and things. And then there was music that I played, which was completely different. And I never put the two together ever in my mind. I never thought, oh, I want to be a pop artist. I want to be on stage. I want to be having my own videos and having my dance crew. I never, ever thought that. And I still don't, actually.
Why do you think that you never thought, oh, if I do this, then I might be
them? I don't know.
Them?
Just never really occurred to me. I just played the piano a lot. And I played the piano all the time, basically. I played the piano, as I now realise, older, having been diagnosed, or ADHD, that I was regulating the whole time. And just, like, being at the piano was the only place that felt sensible to be.
Right.
It made sense. It was calm. It did what I told it. Everything else was shut out. And there was just this relationship that I had with music, which just was always there for me and made me feel safe and centered. And so I never associated music with a job. I guess my parents are very grateful to them that I never felt like, you've got to think about what you're going to do in your life.
Right.
I just was always music everywhere. So they kind of knew before me, I suppose. But I love music. I learned the cello a bit because I wanted to learn about strings. I learned the clarinet because I wanted to learn about woodwind. And I wanted to learn about... I played the trumpet, but really bad. It was painful, so I stopped that. And I just wanted to do as much music as possible. I also found school really boring. So I could get out as many lessons as I could because... I did music, so when I did an extra music lesson, then I would get out of that class and then another class. And then I did theory because I had to get over grade 5 to do the other grades. I liked doing what I wanted to do and wasn't very good at, like, somebody else going, oh, we're going to do this song, or we're going to do this now, I'd be like, I need to jump ahead of that and make a song myself for everyone to sing so that we can sing that, not just Morning Has Broken for the 5 minutes time. So I would write songs and do stuff in my own time. And I did learn how to write notes and stuff early on.
Right.
And I did get a keyboard from a gran. And that's how I started to, like, make beats and stuff.
What was that first keyboard?
I think it was the proper one. It was like a Yamaha PSR 450 or something. You could make beats on it. It was like plastic pads and, you know, maybe like a 5-octave keyboard.
Yeah.
And then I had the cassette recorder, which was like a tape-to-tape cassette recorder. So I could record, like, me playing the pots and pans and then me adding in the cello and then me playing some piano and then me, like, trying to do some beatbox over it or whatever. And I just liked creating the cacophony. And I did write songs for my school. I wrote one of them anyway, at the end of school. And then I went to boarding school when I was 12 and I was a bit strange. Everybody else thought I was a bit strange. I thought they were all strange. And so I spent a lot of my time in the piano room. Even though I wrote songs at that time, I was like 12 or 13, and I just started to sing because my friends liked me to sing stuff. I still hadn't connected it. And even when I went to the Brit school and I was writing tracks on a CD, you know, for the end of year CD, I still wasn't thinking that, to the point when my manager, who was like a temporary teacher at the time somewhere at the Brits, he would like follow me around and say, have you got any more tracks? Because I heard that one on the CD and it's really good.
I can remember something like this to go my way, and it always felt so right. And then you dig it all.
I just thought he was weird and I didn't know what he wanted. I just thought, this is a strange old man, like, not old, but older. So I used to run away from him. And then eventually someone was like, no, he wants to, like, listen to your music because he likes it. Maybe he's like someone in the record industry or something. And I was like, what? What even is that? Like, I didn't even know, even though I was at the Brit school, because it was like the second year in, because I just didn't know what was going on. And I was down the pub half the time. So anyway, eventually I cottoned on and realised that he was a manager and he was interested in me making an album and getting me into the front of a label. And I'm still a bit confused, but I went into the studio with somebody called Nick Kershaw.
Yeah.
And he produced my first song called Come Here Boy. And then all these labels at the time wanted me with that song.
It's dark in the air, visions are flashing into my head as I reminisce my reoccurring dreams, and you said, I'm falling, falling for you, babe. And my feelings are getting stronger, so why don't you stay with me for a little longer? It's only too familiar to your sleep. I can see it in your eyes, and I can tell by your body. Why are you taking so long? You need to come and find me, honey. To set your mind at rest, let your dreams run free. Oh,
What was that first time in the studio like? Because it's so intimidating, but it's a toy shop. It can be a really strange place for an artist the first time in the studio, because it's like, what you've got to put down now is the definitive, air quotes, version of that thing. And that's not always the case for the thing that you're making, but now the pressure is on to make that thing.
Mm. Yeah, it happened very, like, slowly and organically, because at the age of 12, well, I always felt comfortable making beats and recording my voice and all of that stuff. Like, even when I was 12 or before, I went to a boarding school, basically, and then there was a cupboard there, and in the cupboard was an Atari computer.
Right.
And I was like, what does that do? And I really didn't get on with my music teacher at all. I was quite naughty. And so he would put me into the cupboard. And I think he did it knowingly. I think actually he was doing that on purpose in a kind of like affectionate way, that he knew I liked going in there, but I was very disruptive in the class. So, and in the end, the class was just me and him because nobody else did music. So I was just in this cupboard, very small cupboard, and there was an Atari computer with a very kind of basic sound module. And that's where I learned how to write music. Instead of writing it on paper, which I found really annoying, I could do it on the screen and I could hear it back. And that was a total revelation for me. But we didn't have, obviously, hard disk recording or tape to tape or anything like that then. So when I was 17, I got signed. But before that, I'd been at the Brit School, so I knew about studio.
Yeah.
I wasn't intimidated by Nick. He was great. He was super funny. He is super funny. He's so talented. I didn't know his music before I went there. My brother was really like, what? You're going Nick Kershaw? What? So he was like, okay. and I just thought he was great because he did lots of impressions of like people from the Pink Panther and things like that. And he just made me laugh and taught me more about songwriting in a week than the Brit School taught me in 2 or 3 years.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm really grateful to Nick for that. He's a really dear man. But I didn't find that intimidating. And then at my publishing house in Parsons Green, again, I would like turn up, and once they'd shown me what it did, I'd be like, okay, off you go then. I didn't want anyone else in the studio with me, so they would go off and they'd have like basically the day off, and I would just be in there making weird noises and getting them to bring me down cups of tea.
Tell me about first hearing Rival Consoles. Why is that music this important to you?
So I only recently heard about Rival Consoles, and I think it was because of the Spotify algorithm before it went really bad. But I'm doing quite well on Spotify, so I don't... Anyway, blah, blah, blah. I heard Rival Consoles music because I love John Hopkins. I love Clark. I love a bunch of, like, British electronica. I guess at the time, this was, like, about 6 or 7 years ago, I was going through a bit of a shift sexually. I'd never really dated before, and I was sitting in my thing called the listening chair, which is where I chat to my fans. If my AI, Mojen, can't answer any questions, she was a chatbot at the time, then they get through to me directly. And that's where I discovered, actually, maybe I should, you know, get a partner, because I'd been single for a while. So like, why don't you get onto a dating app? So I went onto Bumble or whatever, and I met somebody really amazing that I ended up writing a song about, which is coming out soon. And it was all a bit of a whirlwind. As I now discovered, I'm ADHD, so I get very focused on things, and I basically decided that this was like R&D for me. So I was very prolific out there doing my research and meeting loads of people every day, sometimes more in a day. I just wanted to know all about this world that I really hadn't been paying attention to, because I wasn't very well for a while and I hadn't got diagnosed. I have a Hashimoto's. It's just making me super tired and like overweight. Once I realised that, I basically my sexual energy came back, which I realised is the same thing as my creative energy. I've just been extremely creative my whole life, and I find it hard to do both at the same time, or I just get, I become a bit of a chaotic mess. Anyway, I discovered this whole thing, this sexual energy, and discovered all kinds of things about myself during this process. And Rival Consoles was the music that I would play to kind of cleanse the palate, shall we say, to just kind of regulate in between people that I would meet and just soften the edges and have like a companion in like a musical sound world. And discovered that just came on one day on Spotify playlist, and I was like, wow, I really like this. And then I would go to see shows of his and like turn up on my own and be hi. I think he's great. I love his music and he does great shows.
Turn your ugly face. Are you so surprised to see me? Yeah, I was your little child in a playground toy. And if I remember, yeah, if I do remember rightly, I said the tables will be turned around, boy. Who's getting scared now? Tell me.
Your first album, I mean, what do you remember from doing that first record? It's really interesting.
That album was tough for many reasons that I didn't realise at the time. But essentially, yeah, I was super young. Some of the songs on that album were from when I was 15.
Yeah, yeah, like 15, 16. Yeah.
And then I think I finished recording the first version of the album when I was 19, and that was with Dave Stewart. Yeah. And then the second whole album, the same, as iMegaphone, basically it was recorded twice. No, it's a pretty traumatic experience. I made the beginning bit of the record in Jamaica with Dave Stewart and a gang of people, and it was really fun, and we did all things that you like to do in Jamaica. I also got sunburned and I got like a weird ear infection. I got all kinds of things, but I had a great time, discovered fireflies for the first time in the jungle there. It's beautiful. Wrote some nice songs, nearly got killed by a centipede.
What happened?
Called 40 legs. It's a type of centipede, and I was just like jamming on the keyboard at the time. I think I'd had quite a lot of rum punch, and everybody suddenly wasn't around me, and I was like, where's everybody gone? Like, I was just playing against the wall, you know, because that's where the keyboard was. And then everyone suddenly disappeared behind me, and they were like looking at me, like pointing above my head, and there was this massive centipede. I think it was yellow and black. I can't remember the colours of it now. And they were like, come back.
Get away.
Get back. And so I like whizzed my wheelie chair back to the back of the room. And they're pretty deadly apparently. So I survived, though. I survived, obviously. I went through the whole record. We stayed in this really nice place in LA. I met all kinds of people. I ended up being on one of John Bon Jovi's albums because I figured out one of his songs, which I can't remember the name of it now. It might have been Queen of New Orleans. But I was like 18. There's this hilarious video of me trying to figure out the chords of this track. I was like, whoa, John Bon Jovi's in the house. Maybe I'll go upstairs and just take off my pajamas and put on proper clothes. And then I came down and I had this like baggy jumper thing on that kept falling off my shoulder, and I wasn't doing it purposefully, but Dave Stewart was filming it and he was just like, oh yeah, you're flirting with John, are you? I was like, no, it was just falling off my thing. Anyway, we figured out the chords, and there's somewhere there's a video of me and John sitting at the piano figuring out the chords for his song.
Nothing's what it seems. She was a Venus to Milo in his sister's jeans. Ooh, I was dancing with the Queen of New Orleans. Ooh, dancing in the streets of New Orleans. Ooh, dancing cheek to cheek.
I didn't chat too long. I was a bit intimidated. I just did my job and left and tried to finish my record.
Drink up, baby, down. Are you in all right? Leave your things behind, cause it's all going off without you. Excuse me.
I've got so much affection for Frou Frou. There is a thing. Yeah. But there's something beautiful about, I mean, although you did go back to it, about something that for quite a long time appears in aspic. And people kind of, maybe it's a psychological thing about, oh, there is no more of this, so I will really treasure the thing, the one thing we have got, that one record. And it's kind of lovely to have seen those songs appear in so many different places and people really take that project to their heart.
Yeah, so did we. We were really proud of that record, and we were deeply annoyed that the label did what labels do.
Yeah, so explain a bit about how it did something that was so loved, and also looking at the sales these days, that would be a pretty successful record.
Yeah.
How did it all come to the point where you decided to stop it?
Well, we were both really broke, and we couldn't get off the deal, and they weren't putting it out in a way that would give us any chance of having any success. And they kept saying, oh, you need a hit, you need a hit. So we were like, okay, we're trying to write hits, we're trying to write whatever that is. And we didn't manage to do that. And eventually it was just like, we're just stuck in a rock and a hard place. We, you know, we've made this album, which we thought was really great. And it wasn't getting played on radio, basically, which is back then all you had. Mm-hmm. Unless you got, you know, a sync in a film, which we did, but that didn't happen until like a couple of years later, sadly. Yeah. Had it had gone at the same time with Garden State, then maybe a bit of a different story.
Yeah.
But yeah, it didn't get played on the radio, for whatever reason, which is funny because now it would have done, you know. I guess it just, I don't know, there was a lot of rock bands on the radio at the time. There wasn't really what we were doing anywhere, and I just think we just didn't fit the playlists. And also there was a problem with, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I remember once I had this track called Blanket with Urban Species. That was actually the first track that ever ended up on the radio with my voice on it. They wouldn't playlist it because, well, first of all, they said that it was black music for white people. But they also said, we've already got one female artist on the playlist this week, so...
We've already got one lady, that's it. We can't have more than one. Yeah. That's enough.
So, you know, there's all these funny reasons, isn't there? But why great music just doesn't get discovered and...
But then it does. That's the point. Well, and then sometimes not always.
Yeah.
life finds a way.
I think that's the biggest problem that we have right now. It's just there's so much music and there's so many ways that people can hear music, but how do you really find the ones that you're going to love? I mean, we have amazing DJs. If you have the time to sit and listen to the DJs and really just kind of use them as your curator, I know, and some stuff gets around, obviously, but so much stuff we don't discover. And I think it's really sad. I think we will find ways. I think actually that's the good thing about AI, is I think that we will find really helpful tools about how to match music that people will love with the people that want to hear them better, and that will somehow cut through based on contextual information around, you know, maybe where the song was written or what the topic exactly is, if we can augment the song's information in a place, in a home.
And this is it, because I have, and we're jumping all over the place here, like, I wholeheartedly believe that, but I also love the totally unpredictable. I mean, I remember in my case being 17 and getting a bus back home from the centre of Birmingham and listening to a CD I'd just bought, and it was an Iggy Pop track, and it was nightclubbing, and there was no way that I would have chosen that track. I knew nothing about him other than the fact that Bowie had said he was good. And that was a completely odd, strange piece of music to be hearing on a bus in autumn in Birmingham. And I don't know how an algorithm or AI could have predicted those sequences of events. So I'm with you, I agree. But also that total unpredictability.
Yeah, no, for sure. I don't know. Maybe I'm being in a bit of a downer today about things because of what's going on in our world. Things are often written, especially there's a lot of AI generated music on these DSPs now, and it is clouding how we can magically discover things at those, you know, happy accident cross points that we might have done, like you're saying on the bus there with Iggy Pop. There's just less and less chance of that because of how saturated everything is, because of the way we, you know, inhale information or the way it washes over us and we're not really noticing. It's just harder and harder. And I think because we're living in such a 24/7 data-driven world, that to find our kind of individuality in that and find a way to meet the stuff that's out there, for it to know that it's, that how do we find it and how does it know that we're here? Almost treating IP as an entity in of itself, so that it can discover us too. And I think that will be the power of kind of a really positive thing that could happen out of kind of self-sovereign digital identity, basically, based on the digital identity of the piece of work that we can match in better ways, more meaningful ways, more relevant ways that are hard to be based on just how a song sounds. Oh, if you like that song, then you might like this song. There's no other information, like relevant information about that track, about what it might be about or what kind of gear was used or what kind of charity it might be supporting. I don't know. Off on a tangent, sorry.
It is the anniversary of Speak For Yourself.
Yeah.
Because I remember, I think I probably spoke to you at the time, what you did seemed so surprising at the time, and now it seems like, oh, a totally self-funded, self-created thing. I was like, oh, that's definitely...
Did you speak to me at the time?
I think so, yeah.
That's cool.
I would have been at XFM, I believe.
Oh.
That's how old I am.
I have a really bad memory, so sorry.
That's all right.
That's super cool, thank you.
And now it seems like, oh, of course an artist should be able to, and it's not surprising if they do completely control every aspect of a record. That now seems like how it should be. But at the time, it felt like it was much discussed, you know, you've remortgaged your home. This is a token. And once again, it's another record that's got half-life. What's that thing where like a...
Yeah, half-life.
Where an element never quite disappears. That record's got that sense to it.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's been really just so nice. Every now and then you just get these little presents out of nowhere and you're like, oh, that's really nice that everyone's just really likes Headlock all of a sudden, or and it's just like I wasn't even doing anything, and then there's this extra love, and it really helps with the things that are going on right now, like how to raise awareness of other things which aren't necessarily just songs anymore, but gives me a platform to be able to talk about the other things that I care about in terms of music or technology or identity or AI or whatever, machine learning, because that's kind of where my life is right now in projects. But Headlock, yeah, I'm just so happy. I think it's a great track. And the remaster of the album, which we've just finished, you know, it sounds amazing. And I got the same mastering engineer who did the one back then, because he's brilliant and he lives in Chagford in Devon. In an old cow shed is where his studio is. And I liked it because I grew up in a round house and his studio is a tiny round cow shed. The first people that I spoke to about the order of the album songs were a bunch of cows.
So the cows responsible for the sequencing of the record?
Well, they thought it was a good idea. Yeah. We didn't discuss it much. I think they just went along with it.
I want to talk about the happy song.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, my daughter's six now, but I used to be fascinated by the things when she was much younger that she would connect to. And you could never predict what music she'd associate with and like for air. It was so interesting because sometimes it would be childhood, sometimes it would be extremely noisy stuff or weird avant-garde stuff or really, you know, fun kid stuff. And I was looking a bit at the history of the Happy Song, which I'd like to ask you about.
Yeah.
And one of the quotes was, 26 babies were brought into the lab at Goldsmith University to test out four melodies that Imogen created. And I just got this image of like 26 babies or like in little pushchairs or whatever while you presented.
I got invited in, I can't remember the lady's name. She worked for a company, which I can't remember the name of either, sorry. Felt Music, there we go. And she knew that I just had a baby girl and I was about a year in now. She said, any chance you might want to make a piece of music with some scientists to see if you can make babies happier with it? And I was like, yes, yes. Never been more of a yes in my life than that. I just loved that idea because anything that would help Scout. We still don't really know. It's just like colic or whatever. It's just lots of crying and just feeling a bit hopeless and obviously love her to pieces, but just so hard. Like, really wasn't prepared for it at all. I wrote a song. It's like, it was almost like the A side and the B side. The A side, whichever way around you look at it, is Tiny Human, which is like the reality of being a mother for the first time or being a parent and just tearing your hair out, but just such deep love, but just also just chaos and just help. And then the Happy Song, which is the kind of the antidote. Anyway, I'm still a bit nervous that I'm going to have like a generation of millions of adults that are going to be traumatized by having been played the Happy Song so many times.
Or so, it instilled something
or
in
maybe
them.
Yeah, that's a more positive way of looking at it. I mean, we'll find out because we've got like another 5 more years before we see how the teenagers did. But I think it came from a good place and I really enjoyed it. And it was fun to get Scout involved too. She started off some of the melodies and I got her dad in who did the whistling and then my mum and lots of friends sung at the end chorus and I got my clarinet out.
And you did showcase it in front of a bunch of actual babies.
No, I iterated it with babies. So I came into my studio and I had the notes of what was good and bad about the week's tracks and then I would kind of tweak and have some ideas and then I'd go back and I'd play to them and then see the results and then okay, come back and I'd, you know. So I did that with these two scientists from Goldsmiths. And I didn't personally go in there that much. I think I was like couple of times I actually was with the babies and before the playback, which was very successful. It's amazing. And it changed my life because really? I didn't have any concept of the fact that if it worked, which it does, every single day there's like hundreds of messages from parents
really
just going, hey, I've got this kid's hack, guys, if you've got a baby, blah blah blah, if they're crying in the backseat, and I get them every day, and I get messages on Instagram every
That's
day
amazing.
Just saying thank you so much. There's been like a New York Times piece in it, a New Scientist piece in it. It's crazy, and it really does work. Obviously that sometimes it doesn't work, and that's okay, you know, but I wrote it with the idea that the parents would be able to sing it.
Mm-hmm. Can you do it for teenagers, please? Can you do it for like...
I'm going to.
Can you do it for 17-year-olds?
Yeah, I'd like to do an adult one, because that's needed. I don't know what that would sound like.
It's just very quiet.
Yeah, either like white noise or somehow find the peaceful light within you and that will set you free. I don't know.
Why do you think so much of your work has been sampled and seized upon by other people? Why do you think people find something within it that they want to reinterpret and take on board? And you seem to operate in a very democratic sort of attitude with your music in terms of letting people just get involved with it. Lots of people from lots of different genres seem to find something in it, and that's quite rare. I can't think of many people who have a similar kind of position where you appear in so many different styles of artists. It's very cool.
I feel really lucky. I think it's because I'm actually not super famous and I don't get played in public places a lot.
You think that's what it is?
I think it's because it's like, oh, no one really knows who that is, even though I do quite well.
Yeah.
I can walk down the street and I don't get like accosted for autographs. I think it's partly that. It's like, it sounds great, the production's great, there's loads of layers, there's lots to get stuck into, there's a lot of vocalizations. It's kind of, in a way, not a genre. I don't know. I mean, yes, it has electronic elements, but it's also very song-based. But there's lots of also like orchestral sounds that you might find in them. And sometimes it might be just some piano or I don't know. There's lots of things to latch onto that are not like, oh, I can't listen to that because I don't listen to that kind of music. It's like, well, what kind of music is it? I don't know. I guess it is alternative electronic. I don't know what it is. But I think it's kind of nondescript enough for people to kind of sample it.
I think it's because everybody thinks that they've discovered you and they've found you and you're theirs,
yeah,
which is a lovely thing, even though you do exceptionally well and you've got astonishing career in all sorts of disciplines.
I think the first proper loads and loads of sampling that I heard was ASAP Rocky.
Yeah.
He did a mixtape that was like 15 years ago or something, and I remember hearing it on YouTube and just being like, wow, that's so cool. He had tracks like Kidding, which has never got released. It was like a demo form on piano of a song that I used to sing live a lot, and I think even that was there, and maybe even something like Missing You, which was one of the tracks that I did at Brit School, yes, you know, when I was 15. So I was like, wow, I just felt so, I felt super cool. I was like, oh, that's nice that this guy, he likes my music enough to want to rap on, and I thought it was really good. I think I sent him a message, I don't know how I would have done, maybe on YouTube. I haven't actually met him or anything. But then obviously now he's got this track called A Smoke to Away My Brain.
Stomach pains, now I'm throwing up, cause I'm a microphone fiend. Give me the bass, give me the beat, now let me lean. Tap the vein, let it stream, felt the pain. Young Martin Luther King, what a dream. That one day, me and my team, we could make it with this rap. And now we swag, and making money in Manhattan, trick what's happening. They try to intellect with indirections just to test you. A rebel to my death, it's in my flesh, it's in my vessels. The clicks you with, I'm finna you next to a metrosexual, suck a dick, I'm disrespectful. You know the kid, get it, get sick. Spit click, spit quick, hit, get swimming. Oh, that's your girl, huh? Well, I just hit it, it's ASAP, live with it. She's all around me, I can't be, I'm all alone. Thinking about you, thinking about your attitude. These even though they start to drive me low, don't leave me. Start to drive me low, don't leave me all alone. Thinking about you, attitude.
If you go to Imogen Heap on whatever DSP, it's the top one that comes up.
It is.
Because it samples Just For Now with Clams Casino, and then there's this mashup of two of our songs. I don't know if it's coming close to a billion, but it's a lot of plays. It's crazy. And so, yeah, I have the weirdest, like, top three tracks. I've got, like, ASAP Rocky, Smoked Away My Brain. I've got The Happy Song.
Yep.
And then probably Headlock Now. Yeah. So it's pretty random. In fact, there's something very hilarious that happened. I'll just tell you. So The Happy Song,
yeah,
it's getting played all the time on TikTok. And there's this one woman, and somebody sent me this clip, and it's just so funny. So she's like, okay, she's American. I'm not going to do the American accent, but she's like, she's American. She's like, okay, my friends, you need to check out Imogen Heap, The Happy Song, because I played this to my daughter. She loved it. And then one day I was like, who is this lady anyway? And so she said, my husband went onto Spotify or Apple Music or whatever and saw her profile picture, and she's demonic. And then there's this picture of me in this hilarious, like, it's because it's the song that's just coming out, with me in this like spiky outfit that I made out of panko breadcrumbs and this kind of 3D printed thing on my head. And I do look slightly demonic. But then there's like, I Smoked Away My Brain, you know, that came underneath it. And a song that I've just released called Noise, which is like really intense. It is just basically noise that took me about 3 months to craft. It's my favourite piece of music I've ever done. Or noise. First piece of noise. Anyway, and she's terrified. She's just like, you need to stop playing this person. She's a cult leader, you know. And so I just love it. I really want to do like a reply video of me and like my dad, like looking like a hunchback in all black, and like kids screaming in the back, and just think that'd be quite funny, but I haven't got the time.
Looking back, I've kind of got an idea about how your career kind of feels. It's like a weird mix of, on the one hand, this idea of complete control of this is what I would like to do and this is how I'm going to do it and this is when and who and where it's going to work.
No, no.
And the other half of me sees it as being the exact opposite. It's like, totally, I just want to put opposite. It all to chance.
Yeah.
I want to break the normalcy of creating music and see what happens when I do
that.
Yeah,
100%.
And it seems to be both those things.
I mean, in the studio, I sent myself completely mad. I'm not even joking. I'm like, I've lost it.
Really?
In the studio. Yeah.
What happened?
Well, basically, the technology allows me to become so obsessive.
Mm.
And actually, for a period of time, I took some ADHD drugs. I didn't realize I was autistic at the time, which might seem strange to some people. And I think what it ended up doing was it shined such a light on my autism by kind of dealing with the ADHD stuff, that I became so hyper-focused on something that I was like in my studio for hundreds of hours or thousands of hours drawing out little kind of artifacts in my voice. I can't describe it.
So little sort of characteristics within the way that you'd say.
Yeah, because one of the bits of the track is AI-generated. My voice, but it's AI-generated. Yeah. So there's like lots of artifacts because it doesn't really sound like me. So I was trying to make it sound like me. And then in the process, I started to hear all these little lines and I could see things in the waveform. And oh my God. And then, oh God, I feel ridiculous even saying it. So my new thing is that now that track is finished, thank goodness, because it took me 4 years to do. It's in three parts. So I've got What Have You Done To Me? That's the first part. Came out December last year, my birthday. What have you done to me?
Everybody stand their hands down.
Noise, which is the second part, which mm-hmm. came out of just something crazy that's happened as a result of listening to certain pieces of noise, that I've realised that music all along has been my companion, and I've avoided loneliness. And I didn't really know what loneliness felt like until I heard this piece of noise, and I realised that I've been missing out on human interaction because of music. And I'm there in the studio like thousands of hours being a complete nerd. And in the meantime, the whole world is like out doing things and going on holiday and spending time with their friends and going out doing stuff. And I'm just doing that. So I kind of realised that I've become a bit of a slave to my own obsession, because the technology allows me to have hundreds of tracks and allows me to have that detail, that visual detail as well. So I have put that song to bed now. I'm really proud of it. It's amazing. I love it so much as a piece of work. It's 13 minutes, 33 seconds long, and it has these three distinct sections, which are all about kind of sexual experiences and exploring power dynamics. And then there's a noise section, which is like the obliteration of the ego. And then there's the aftercare section, which is to see what happened, what wells up after the noise. Because basically the noise, I realised, was touching all the bits of my body that was storing almost, this sounds like madness, I know, but this is how I kind of make sense of it in my mind. Because I had such a physical reaction to noise that was not either pleasurable or not nice, that I just couldn't explain. The way that I figured it out in my head is that all these years of kind of feeling like I'm writing cathartically is not really doing it. It's just kind of covering it up, or it's just kind of like, oh, that's dealt with now. Now I can go and do this. And actually, I never really dealt with things. And so I think that the noise, there's that peace in there that comes with the chaos. And so this track, especially noise, I realised that the pleasure pace in life is where order meets chaos. And my order in music is very far down now. I can't have simple, I have these very complex tracks. And it's got a hold of me so much that it's kind of taken over my life. And I can't seem to let anyone else in to the studio, I never have. So my next phase of my life, I'm developing more and more with my glove system that I built with team people over the years, yeah. a way to kind of mainline presence through improvisation, gestural interface with the computer, so that I can improvise and I want to learn how to essentially create lyrics in real time, so I don't have to sit and record stuff and just get the sound really good using AI as well as a kind of augmenting about kind of gathering in information, like could be climate information, or it could be, you know, how many people in the audience or where they are positioned to the stage or whatever. And that kind of gets funneled into MoGen as a kind of data center that plays out in different ways. Anyway, so for me, it's like there's so much stuff that gets perfected and we don't really know what's real anymore. And I feel like we're kind of losing ourselves a bit. And the connection between people is becoming further and further away, between our money, between our food, between everything. And so I just want to be present. I want to be present with people in a room, and I want to be making music in real time. Not something that I've pre-written that's been in the past. I want to manifest basically what's going on right there live with all of us in the room, whether that's something that's going on in the news or whatever it is, but just together that I conjure this music, this kind of, to be as present as possible, because I love going to see concerts. When I'm there in the audience, I'm feeling hyper-present. I'm just like, wow, this music is incredible. I'm feeling my whole body alive and isn't life great? And that's because you're not thinking about the future and you're not thinking about the past. You're only in the positive present. But yet when you're on stage, you are rehashing something that you've written in the past, yeah. reliving a bit sometimes. Or I might be thinking about what I've got to do next. What's the song I've got to do next? What am I meant to say? Who I've got to thank? You know, what's going on? What do I need to say about the city? Whatever it is. And I'm not really present. I'm present in the moment of the performance, but only momentarily.
Yeah.
And so I want to be in the same place as the audience. I want to be present. I want to be there just being, essentially. And I think the only way that I can do that now, having just literally nearly killed myself in the studio for the past 4 years, that's what I want to do. Yeah. So I've kind of, I don't really want to sit and write songs anymore. I want to do lots of collaborations, but I find it hard to, if somebody wants to collaborate with me, I can't help it. I'm like, oh, I'll do that, and I'll do this, and I'll do that, and I'm just going to do this, and it takes me 2 weeks. I do want to do it, but I also don't want to do it, because I want to live. I want to be out, and I want to be with people, and I want to see the grass, I want to go see the sky. So, yeah.
And the final thing, what piece of music should we go out on? What's the last song we should play?
You can either play the full thing, which is I Am, which would be very brave of you because it's 13 minutes and 32 seconds and people might switch off because of the noise section. Or you could play Aftercare, which in of itself is a smaller 4-minute piece, which is the final piece, which has harkings to Hide and Seek, only in the melody, which I didn't realise at the time. Here and now is all there is. What comes before and after this are made of moments just like this. So take a breath and breathe. Breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. Everything that you already have is everything you'll ever need, basically.
It's been lovely to speak. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Aftercare by Imogen Heap, my guest on The First Time today. And that's the end of this show. I'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guests will be Rat Scabies from punk pioneers The Damned. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, including my conversations with Self Esteem, Florence Welch, John Cale from The Velvet Underground, Tom York, who's done some gigs recently, and our show with the late, great Jimmy Cliff. Until then, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.